loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by Nicole Roussel and Walter Smolarek. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, NBC News yesterday broke a story that the FBI has been monitoring the phones, email, and text messages of President Trump's personal attorney, Michael Cohen, and that the monitoring began months before the press ever got wind that Cohen was the subject of any investigation. Civil libertarians are decrying what appears to be the blatant and wanton disregard of attorney-client privilege. And then, economic and political turmoil continue in Venezuela ahead of the crucial May 20th presidential election. But the causes and consequences are misrepresented in the mainstream media. Two Venezuelan human rights activists join the show to help us separate fact from fiction. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, thousands of Palestinians staged a sixth weekly protest today against Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands, with some throwing stones and burning tires while Israeli soldiers fired live rounds. More than 170 people were wounded today. Since late March, 39 Palestinians have been killed and more than 1,700 wounded by Israeli fire during the protests. Next, the United States warned China yesterday that there would be consequences for its growing militarization of disputed islands in the South China Sea, amid reports that it has deployed missiles to that area. The threat comes amid continued talks between the two countries to try to solve a major trade dispute and follows a formal complaint to Beijing over Chinese lasers being used to blind U.S. pilots in the Horn of Africa. Then, a delegation of members of Veterans for Peace has carried out massive civil disobedience demonstrations in front of the main gate at Camp Schwab, the U.S. military base on the island of Okinawa. The group is showing its resistance to the base by blocking truck traffic into and out of that gate. And then, some states are turning to a supply and demand-based system for toll roads, with skyrocketing costs for the consumer. The Wall Street Journal and others have been reporting on this change, asking the question, what is the best mechanism for reducing congestion? But is that the right question to ask about our infrastructure needs? And finally, we'll continue to look at the worst and most misleading headlines of the week. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. And in other headlines, after facing pressure and mass demonstrations, including 850,000 people at March for Our Lives, President Trump briefly said that he would fight the NRA while he was in Parkland, Florida, at the site of the school shooting. But today he's delivering an address to the NRA in Dallas, Texas, noting, quote, "We have to win the midterms," unquote. 70 people entered the U.S. to seek asylum this morning, bringing the total to 145 people who have arrived in the much-discussed caravan through Central America to the U.S. border. This caravan is not the first, but it has gotten the most attention after the president tweeted negatively about it. The migrants are from Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Nicaragua. The April jobs report was released today, showing that the official unemployment rate fell to 3.9%. However, in terms of absolute numbers, only 164,000 jobs were added, substantially weaker growth than in previous months. The Department of Labor publishes six unemployment rates each month, and the official rate, also known as the U3 number, does not count workers who are considered to have dropped out of the labor market as a consequence of being unable to find a job for 6 months or more. Two Native American boys were pulled from a college tour by security officers due to a parent complaining that they made her nervous. They had scraped together enough money to fund the trip, borrowed the family car, and were late to arrive to the tour. The boy's mother has taken to local news and to Facebook to talk about the incident, saying, "The boys were shy and quiet and weren't actively participating in the tour banter, so someone got nervous and called campus police on them." The police officer pulled them aside and the tour continued without them. Those are today's headlines. Next up is a conversation about the Trump administration this week, including whether ex-lawyer Michael Cohen was wiretapped and how Trump's new legal team is doing. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
But first we turn to the scandal enveloping the White House. NBC News yesterday broke a story that the FBI has been monitoring the phones, email, and text messages of President Trump's personal attorney, Michael Cohen, and that the monitoring began months before the press ever got wind that Cohen was the subject of any investigation. Civil libertarians are decrying what appears to be the blatant and wanton disregard of attorney-client privilege. We're joined from Minnesota by Colleen Rowley. She's a former FBI special agent who in 2002 was named Time Magazine's Person of the Year, along with two other whistleblowers. And we're joined from Washington by Dan Kovalik. He is the human rights and labor lawyer who's been on the show before, and he's the author of a soon-to-be-released book, The Plot to Attack Iran. Welcome to both of you.
Hi there.
Thank you.
Colleen, let's start with you. And I should point out that both of you are attorneys, so I'm glad we have the opportunity to have this conversation. Colleen, I'm not a lawyer, but this just screams out to me as a violation of constitutional rights and attorney-client privilege. You don't have to be a fan of Donald Trump's to say that every American ought to have the privacy to speak with his own attorney, or am I seeing this incorrectly?
Well, the Sixth Amendment right to attorney and right to legal representation has at least one big exception to it, and that's the crime fraud exception. You can't merely hire an attorney, in this case, for instance, which is seeming more and more likely, for instance, to be your own private slush fund. Or for instance, a corporation cannot hire an attorney to somehow legalize dropping toxins in a river and then say that's covered by attorney-client privilege. So if the attorney is part of the crime, and that does look like it was always the theory that came across Mueller apparently first, and then he referred it to the FBI. But it looks like this was always the theory that Cohen was not covered by attorney-client privilege due to the crime to his participation in a crime fraud. Now, if they sought a pen register to monitor Cohen's telephone calls and email communications, that only allows them to see who the entities or the persons he's in touch with. It does not allow them to get the substance as would a FISA warrant, as was the case in Carter Page, for instance, when they got a whole year long ability to intercept Carter Page. So this is a pen register is extremely easy to obtain. You do not have to show probable cause. And so that's the best I can make of what we're seeing.
Okay, so they're not getting the actual transcripts from the phone calls and the text messages and emails and such. They're just getting the metadata. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I think it is. Yeah, it's a pen register, and it's just the to and from, and it does not require probable cause. It basically just requires a case being open. It has to be relevant to the investigation. So there's no real high standard of evidence or proof for that. And in most cases, it's almost an automatic. It's an automatic. If you open a drug case, for instance, the first thing you would do is put up pen registers. So I think that's what's gone on with Cohen, as they were monitoring who he was in touch with. They don't know, obviously, what he was saying in those conversations. The only way they would know that is if they got an actual Title III warrant, and a Title III criminal warrant to actually surveil someone does require a high level of probable cause, even higher than a search warrant. And they would not have possessed that amount of evidence at the start of this looking at Cohen.
Dan Kovalik, should we assume then from all of this that a crime likely has been committed and that Cohen is going to be charged with something?
I think it's probably a good assumption that they feel they have enough to go after him at this point. Though, you know, obviously there's a presumption of innocence, so I don't want to say we should assume a crime's committed, but they obviously feel they have enough to maybe at least bring down an indictment at this point.
Let me ask you a follow-up. Sorry, Walter. Follow-up on that. NBC reported yesterday something that was fascinating to me, and it just shows you how crazy, how almost circus-like things are in the White House right now. NBC says this: two sources close to Trump's attorney, Rudolph Giuliani, say Giuliani learned that days after the raid, the president called Cohen, and Giuliani told Trump never to call him again out of concern that the call was being recorded by prosecutors. Walk us through that.
You know, that seems to suggest that, in fact, you know, the calls are being monitored for substance and not just, in terms of who Cohen is speaking to. But in fact, they may have a broader search ability, and that they are surveying the calls. So, again, I would think that is of some concern. I think, that while Colleen's right, there is a crime fraud exception to the attorney-client privilege. The bar for overcoming that is very, very high. And I think all of us should be concerned that this type of surveillance is going on. Though I think after Edward Snowden, I think a lot of us assume that pretty much we're all under surveillance.
Yeah.
Most of the time.
Yeah. Hate to say it, but I agree.
Yeah. So Colleen, I mean, could investigators then sort of retroactively decide to get the content of some of these calls? I mean, if the, you know, it's just the metadata, just, you know, who's being called at what time that's being, you know, recorded by the PIN register because of, you know, the comprehensive surveillance state infrastructure that's been set up in the past, you know, say 10 years, 20 years, would they be able to, at some later point in the investigation, retrieve the content, or is that not in question?
Well, I'm just going to make one additional point about this, which is the revelations that Giuliani made yesterday in talking to Sean Hannity, where he basically admitted that Trump had repaid Michael Cohen.
Right.
Which indicates that this was a quote-unquote slush fund, as opposed to a campaign contribution. So Giuliani is saying this in order to get out from under the allegation that it was a campaign contribution. No. It wasn't an illegal campaign contribution. Trump paid it back. Unfortunately, that undercuts the argument that this is not crime fraud. It actually helps the government's argument that this is the crime fraud exception, because an attorney is supposed to provide legal advice, et cetera. He's not supposed to be acting as a slush fund to pay off people, et cetera. So that I just wanted to mention that part because it's very germane to where this is going. Now, this is a criminal investigation. Mueller handed it off back to the FBI and said, because it's Stormy Daniels and paying off a woman, it has nothing to do with the so-called Russia collusion, et cetera.
Right.
So I'm handing it back. Now, in a criminal case, you can't go to the NSA, who is the vacuum. The vacuum of all of our communications is the NSA. And while there has been some cooperation where the NSA would hand over, let's say, a drug dealer or some other crime to the FBI, and Mueller admitted that then we do parallel construction and we try to create a new evidence instead of using that NSA, I don't think in this case that it would be very highly, I think, surprising that somehow they would go back to the NSA afterwards and say, we want the content of earlier communications with Cohen. I mean, the problem is, Dan Kovalik is right. It's not just the Sixth Amendment. Since the war on terror, we've been in virtually a form of martial law where almost all of the Bill of Rights have been, pretty much destroyed. And it's uneven. It doesn't affect average people, you know, who are paying their taxes and whatever and working for a salary. But for the people in power, this is now being used. All of these tools of surveilling each other is working out on kind of this power mongering is what you see. I constantly say the pots are calling the kettles black as you see one side going after another. And I have to say, what's missing in all of these power mongering is Russia collusion.
Yeah.
Because they're tearing each other down. But Russia she didn't put Stormy Daniels up to this. She didn't put Michael Cohen up, Russia did not put Michael Cohen or Manafort or any of these people up to it.
You know, this is such an important sub-story to this whole thing too, and I want to come back also to Dan's point about the Snowden revelations. There was a very interesting correction that was issued yesterday by NBC News. NBC said that there had been a wiretap on Cohen's phones, and they used the word wiretap. The government immediately objected and said there was no wiretap. The phones were monitored, which means they were just hoovered up, as Colleen said a moment ago. The truth is, we don't wiretap anything anymore because the technology has moved beyond that, as Ed Snowden told us. Now, literally everything is scooped up. You don't need a wiretap. So I think it's actually more serious than most people realize. And Dan, I want to turn to you. I want to read you something else that was in this original NBC News report. It says, Two sources close to Giuliani also described him as having warned Trump that Cohen is likely to flip on him, something Trump pushed back on, telling Giuliani that he's known Cohen for years and expects him to be loyal. Do you buy that? Or do you think that it's going to be every man for himself, as we usually see in cases like this?
Cohen seems pretty loyal, given that he apparently put up a mortgage to make that payment to Stormy Daniels to begin with. But look, I think when push comes to shove, people will often do practically anything to avoid jail time themselves. But if he rolls over too much, that is to say, if he himself breaks attorney-client privilege to do that, he also doesn't have much of a career after this as a lawyer. So he has a very tough decision to make. Let's put it that way. If he rolls over him in order to stay out of jail, then he probably needs to find a new career.
Colleen, what's the best possible outcome here for Michael Cohen? Does he automatically lose his law license over all of this? Is there a way that he can avoid prison and still keep his law license? Or do you think he's finished in the legal profession?
You know, even the Watergate people, they may have been finished legally, but they still became talking heads on television, et cetera. And these were even the people with direct involvement. So I don't think life is over for him. I think he'll probably be able to bounce back and do other types of things. But the legal profession itself is taking a big hit with all the pots calling the kettle black. And in the latest, of course, there's even one more wrinkle here, which is that in the Manafort case, the judge is questioning whether Mueller is exceeding his mandate of, again, this was supposed to involve Russia collusion, and Manafort case involves bank fraud from years before. And so you're seeing this kind of a witch hunt. I think that you can fairly characterize the Mueller investigation as a witch hunt. And when you're going after powerful, wealthy people with all kinds of business deals around the world, you are going to be, and then, of course, the problem with Trump and as with other powerful men like Clinton and the sex affairs, you are going to be able to find dirt. It's not going to be hard. The question is, what good is this doing anybody? The legal profession is going to suffer as a result, and probably already is suffering.
Wow. Dan Kovalik, the case that Colleen's talking about right now was heard today, at least the initial hearing was today, in the Eastern District of Virginia, in Alexandria, Virginia, before Judge T.S. Ellis III, who I can tell you is kind of a hanging judge. But Manafort and his attorneys went to the Eastern District to argue that the charges lodged against Manafort in that district ought to be dismissed because they have nothing whatsoever to do with the original case, which has been filed in Washington. And according to the Washington Post, it appears that Judge Ellis agreed with Manafort's attorneys. Is this a way for Paul Manafort to save himself? Do you think that he has anything to this argument?
Well, I'm a little surprised that the argument would be accepted. I mean, there's a lot of reasons to criticize Mueller for exceeding the scope of his investigation, but I think that's more of a political issue. Obviously, once a prosecutor starts looking into something and they find other things, it's hard to say, hey, you were looking for something else, but you found this. I mean, you know, with Nixon, for example, the break-in, which led to everything being exposed, that was just the tip of the iceberg, of course, and that tends to be the case. And moreover, we see, by the way, in the state of New York, of course, that they're very intent on prosecuting Manafort under state law if something happens with the federal cases. So I think probably he is still in a lot of heat at this point.
You know, Colleen, when Rudy Giuliani, who's, you know, a new addition to Trump's legal team, one of, you know, several new additions to Trump's legal team, went on TV and, you know, admitted that that Donald Trump repaid Michael Cohen for that payment to Stormy Daniels. That apparently completely blindsided, like, pretty much everybody else in the administration and even in Trump's inner circle who may not have, like, an official White House post. It seems like it was, according to some reports, was basically only discussed between Rudy Giuliani and Donald Trump. When you're involved in, like, highly complex and high-stakes legal proceedings like the one that President Trump is embroiled in right now, I mean, how important is the coordination between all the different parts of the legal team? I mean, how much trouble is he in as a consequence of this?
Well, of course, Trump is trying to defend this really I would say, mistake on the part of Giuliani by saying Giuliani didn't know the facts. He's new and he really didn't know what he was talking about. That's how Trump is trying to spin it, because Giuliani is a loquacious guy who flies by the seat of his pants. My opinion, I worked, in the Southern District in the 80s when Giuliani was U.S. attorney. And I don't think Giuliani even deserves this reputation as being a competent attorney. He had a lot of really stellar assistant U.S. attorneys like Chertoff working for him that, and of course, he was just the boss of the office. And so there's a lot. You see how history gets rewritten. When they named Giuliani as Trump's attorney, I said, oh, my goodness, unbelievably incompetent. How long will it be? And it really was just a couple of days. This was a big mistake on the part of Giuliani to admit that. Again, he was trying to defend against the campaign contribution argument, but he probably dug the hole even deeper in some respects. And so it's a mess and a half. What's Trump going to do? The other guy that was hired from the Clinton investigation, and in talking about these special counsels, the Whitewater special counsel investigation turned into Monica Lewinsky gate.
Yeah.
So taking stuff into sex allegations, which is where this, you know, again, there was, you know, saying it was based on Russia collusion, and now turning into a payment for a one-night stand is a pretty incredible situation.
Dan, I want you to look into a crystal ball for a minute. I read in the Washington Post this morning that Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the infamous White House spokesperson, said that that the first she learned about Rudy Giuliani's interview with Sean Hannity, where he made this bombshell revelation, was when she was sitting at home watching Rudy Giuliani's interview with Hannity. She had no idea that Giuliani was going on the Hannity show. Nobody in the White House communications office had any idea, which points to either a rogue attorney in the form of Rudy Giuliani or an utterly dysfunctional White House communications office. It seems to me that heads ought to roll here, but there's no indication that that's going to happen. How do you think this plays out?
Well, I mean, this just seems par for the course for the Trump White House. I mean, they always seem to be in this state of chaos. As Colleen just indicated, you know, Trump's now trying to say that, well, Giuliani doesn't even have the facts straight. He was wrong with what he said. Of course, Trump hasn't explained how he was wrong. But, I mean, the fact that you'd have an attorney going on air within a day of being hired and then you're claiming he totally misspoke, I mean, just suggests that the White House is in complete freefall. And, you know, it's anyone looking at this has to be concerned that, you know, the most powerful country in the world is being led by what appears to be a chaotic and erratic leadership.
Colleen Rowley, what does the timing in terms of the midterm elections mean for this? Like, you know, of course, Mueller, you know, if somebody asked him that, he would say, well, this is a completely independent investigation. We don't make political calculations like that. But I mean, of course they do. When you're investigating the sitting president of the United States in his inner circle, it's every calculation you make is inherently political. Are we going to see sort of rapid developments leading up to the midterm election, or are they going to want to say, like, well, you know, we don't want to be seen as directly interfering in the legal process? You know, there was lots of that in 2016. We don't want to get wrapped up in that, and we'll wait until after the elections to really make our move.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think the polls are showing that the Democrats are leading in a lot of these open congressional races now. And Mueller, definitely, he's not apolitical. He has a good sense of where things are going. I think almost all of them do. I don't think they really have to necessarily make too many more moves, like, for instance, more charging or release a report or something like that. Because as Dan just mentioned, this is almost a free fall. And as long as a free fall, disintegration, and again, all the pots calling all the kettles black and vice versa, the kettles calling the pots black. And it's a good guess as to how the public is interpreting all this. Again, how we can think of ourselves as exceptional and want the rest of the world to follow our example is beyond me when we have such a mess and a half in Washington, D.C. But, you know, the polls haven't changed a whole lot other than it does show, I think, the Democrats in the lead. So I really doubt Mueller will do anything overtly political unless there's a real lull in the action and somehow it seems like maybe that they need to do something.
You know, Dan, Colleen's right. This doesn't happen in a vacuum. There's got to be some kind of political fallout. Even Fox News yesterday, at least some of the hosts on Fox News yesterday, began to turn against Donald Trump. We've already seen it with Shep Smith on his shows. But yesterday, Neil Cavuto just skewered the president, saying that everything he says is either a lie or a false statement, and saying that the president is going to drag down Republicans running in House and Senate races across the country. Do you think that this is going to spill over into these races, or do you think that these Republicans running for lower offices can separate themselves successfully from Donald Trump?
Well, that's always a tough question, but I think it's got to hurt. I mean, the problem, and I always thought when the Stormy Daniels story broke that this would be the thing to bring him down, not Russiagate, because one, there's not much substance to Russiagate, but two, I don't think people are as interested in it. This is a sort of thing that conservatives in particular are not going to like, you know, cheating with a porn star and then paying her off to keep quiet is something that is not going to help him with his base, obviously, and I think that this probably, I do believe this is going to be his Achilles heel, and it'll probably bring down many Republicans with him.
Yeah, I think we're probably headed in that direction. I just don't see how this ends well. You know, nobody wants to see the president of the United States crashing and burning because it harms all of us. It harms us as individuals. It harms us as a country. Our allies overseas look at us and shake their heads and they see weakness. But at the same time, it's, you know, how do you get past something like this? I just don't understand. I think it's going to get worse before it gets better.
And you know, we just have a minute or two left, but one last point that I want to ask you, Colleen, about this. You know, Rudy Giuliani, it's kind of ironic that, you know, we're talking about surveillance, especially in the first half of this segment, and, you know, the PIN register, you know, or wiretap or whatever, you know, the controversy about that with Michael Cohen. A lot of that was implemented in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, and Rudy Giuliani was, I mean, leading the charge in that. In addition to that, you know, the whole drug war, tough on crime thing that also had a lot to do with the expansion of the surveillance state. I mean, what an irony that now Rudy Giuliani somehow is still a prominent player in U.S. politics and is getting sort of, you know, caught up or ensnared in some of the creations, you know, of his own earlier actions.
This is, you know, the beauty of karma or blowback is that there are these natural forces where when people really violate longstanding universal principles, you know, for instance, the Bill of Rights, and they do it for opportunistic reasons, and you had a whole slew of people doing that after 9/11. Many of them now have fallen victim to their own, you know, excesses. And they thought this was only going to be targeted on others and not on themselves. And now they fall victim. I mean, this is kind of a, you know, divine justice in a way. And I take some heart in it because there's not much else you can take heart in right now.
Yeah, that's about the size of it. We have to leave it there because we're out of time. We were joined from Minnesota by Colleen Rowley. Colleen is a former FBI special agent who in 2002 was named Time Magazine Person of the Year, along with two other whistleblowers. And we were joined from here in Washington by Dan Kovalik. He's a human rights attorney and labor lawyer who is the author of the soon-to-be-released book, The Plot to Attack Iran. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back. You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker. Economic and political turmoil continue in Venezuela ahead of the crucial May 20th presidential election, but the causes and consequences are misrepresented in the mainstream U.S. media. We're pleased today to be joined by two Venezuelan human rights activists to help us separate fact from fiction. You'll be hearing the voice of interpreter Leonardo Flores. We are joined in studio by Eugenia Rusian. She is the president of the Latin American Foundation for Human Rights and Social Development, the oldest human rights organization in Venezuela, and she has been a nun with the Missionaries of Christ for over 20 years. And we are also joined in studio by Desiree Cabrera. She is a member of the Committee of Victims of Violent Protests. In 2014, the nursery where her 19-month-old baby was being cared for was attacked by right-wing protesters. Eugenia, let's start with you. Tell us a little bit about the work of your organization.
Funda Latin is Venezuela's oldest human rights organization. It was founded 40 years ago, in 1978. As a human rights organization, we have consultative status at the United Nations. We are accredited as a civil society organization at the Organization of American States. And we've worked for over 40 years for the promotion and defense of human rights. And the Committee of the Victims of Violent Protests was created in 2014 in light of the violence that took place generated by the opposition in the country. It's a human rights group that unites all the victims of political violence in Venezuela.
And since 1998, when Hugo Chavez was elected president, when the process of change that's referred to as the Bolivarian Revolution took place, what do you think the difference is between the human rights situation in the Fourth Republic and the human rights situation in the Fifth Republic that was set up as part of the Bolivarian process?
So during the Fourth Republic, there were many human rights issues that were made invisible. We had forced disappearances, torture, many systematic violations of human rights. In 1999, when the new constitution was formed through the Bolivarian process, we started creating public policies related to human rights. The Ombudsman of the People was created, which is in charge of human rights in the country. The constitution has an entire section on human rights. A human rights commission was created to help draft the 1999 constitution. And in the past 20 years, we created the National Human Rights Council. As a human rights organization, we can bear witness that all of these public policies have advanced the human rights situation in Venezuela and have brought dignity to the people. And that's where we can see the big difference in the last 20 years of human rights in Venezuela, how the progress that has been made.
And in your view, what does human rights encompass? I mean, in the United States, when we hear politicians talk about human rights, they mean, like civil liberties, you know, the right to a free press or free speech or free assembly. But they don't talk about social rights, you know, the right to education, the right to healthcare. Comment on that a little bit, if you would. What's your definition of human rights?
So human rights are often used in a political way, and they're often used as an excuse to create war, to invade countries, and to create economic blockades like Venezuela is living through the coercive measures that the U.S. is imposing against Venezuela. But we have to understand human rights from a comprehensive viewpoint. It's about the dignity of people. It's about their ability to have good education, housing, social security.
Desiree, let's turn to you. Tell us about the Committee of Victims of Violent Protests, and how did you become involved in that organization?
So thank you so much for having us here and for this interview. The Committee of the Victims of Violent Protests unites all the victims, whether they're direct victims or indirect victims, from the violent actions that took place in 2013, 2014, and now 2017. In 2014, the opposition carried out a strategy called the exit, which was based on street violence, and this violence led to the deaths of 43 people and many more injured. In my case, there was a call for a protest where I worked, which was the housing ministry, and the protesters came and they attempted to burn our office. And our office holds a nursery school, which is where my child was held, being cared for at the time. So the victims came together to make visible the real events that took place in that time, because the media at the time was also making the victims invisible. So the perpetrators claimed that they were political prisoners, that they were being oppressed by the government. And what was happening was that the actual victims were made invisible. So we formed a truth campaign, and we spoke with many international human rights organizations to talk to them about the reality on the ground in Venezuela. But these efforts were mostly in vain, because these organizations, instead of listening to us and our point of view, they focused more on what the perpetrators were saying.
You know, one of the organizers of these violent demonstrations was an opposition leader named Leopoldo Lopez. And Leopoldo Lopez is portrayed in the Western media as, you know, this heroic defender of democracy. He's, you know, a political prisoner. How do you react when you hear people say things like that?
That's exactly what we're trying to show. We have to demonstrate that Leopoldo López was the one who promoted violence in Venezuela. The problem is that he is presented in the media as a victim, but the actual victims were the families who had people die, the many people that were injured.
And in addition to, you know, attacks on government offices, on symbols of the government or the Bolivarian Revolution, during these violent demonstrations, there were also guarimbas, the roadblocks. Tell us about those. How did they disrupt and bring violence to everyday life in Venezuela? You know, in the 2014 sort of spasm of violence, you know, where you became a victim of the right-wing demonstrations, and also, you know, later on in other iterations of opposition protests.
So the guarimbas were basically these street barricades that were always violent. And one of the examples is that they would hang razor wire across the streets for people on motorcycles to crash against. And one of my colleagues is the father of a man named Ender Duran, who was decapitated when he was riding a motorcycle and he crossed one of these razor wires. They also lifted the sewer grates of the streets, which are kind of that go across the streets in Venezuela, and to cause people to crash their motorcycles or crash their cars. They attacked people for simply even looking like they support the government. They sometimes even burned them. And that's how Orlando Figuera died, because he was burned alive. And with snipers on roof, they would shoot at police officers and other security agents who were trying to reestablish order on the streets. And we have to be very responsible also. In 8 of the 43 cases of dead people, we saw that they were the victims of human rights violations committed by security agents. And these agents are behind bars. But we also have to remember that in the other 35 cases, the victims were victims of political violence by the opposition.
And many of those victims, Eugenia, let's turn to you. Many of those victims were Afro-Venezuelans, including the man who is lit on fire. Tell us about how racism plays into some of the political violence and human rights abuses that we see.
So, yes, in Venezuela, we have many organized Afro-Venezuelans who are taking part in this struggle for furthering human rights. They took part in the National Human Rights Plan. In Venezuela, we have people from all over the world, many migrants. We have indigenous people. We have Afro-Venezuelans. Generally, in Venezuela, it's a country that really respects humanity and respects human beings. But lately, what we're seeing is opposition violence directed at people of color, because there's this idea that if you're a person of color, then you automatically support Chavismo or the Bolivarian Revolution.
And how has the Venezuelan constitution and some of the programs that the Bolivarian missions that were set up as a consequence address some of the longstanding inequalities for Afro-Venezuelans, for indigenous Venezuelans, for communities that had been left out of society or left behind by society and the government?
So, yes, the missions arose as a way to escape from the state bureaucracy and help people directly. Their goal is to help, you know, the people who have been most vulnerable situations, the ones that have been most marginalized. And an example of this is that in the poorest neighborhoods in our country, we now have clinics where doctors go directly and work directly in these communities so that they have direct access to healthcare. We have a law that protects women from violence, and we've seen a huge increase in women's participation in our democracy and everything related to how they defend themselves within our country. We also have social missions dedicated towards helping people with disabilities so that they could be included in the job market and have access to jobs as everyone else, and to also receive benefits that will help them. So we also have this mercantilist system. Well, a mercantilist system generally does away with seniors and forgets about them. But we, on the other hand, we have 3 million seniors who now receive full pensions. And we also have communities that have received low cost or free housing. And despite the economic blockade we are suffering, we see that there has been a continued emphasis on all these social policies to protect the most vulnerable. What we see in capitalism is that when there's a crisis, the first things to go are social programs, and when the banks become a priority. But here, where we've done the opposite, in response to this induced blockade and this induced crisis in our country, the emphasis has been on protecting people and protecting our social gains and our social programs. That's why we denounced this fact at the Inter-American Court of Commission of Human Rights this morning, because this economic blockade, what it can result in is a is a lack of progress or moving backwards, rolling back all of these gains that we've made in human rights and social policy. And so that's why we insisted that the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights from the Organization of American States make a statement against these coercive unilateral measures by the United States, which are harming the Venezuelan people, because these measures don't affect individual officials, as they may claim. They affect the entire Venezuelan population.
Desiree, we're just a couple weeks away from the presidential election. President Nicolas Maduro is facing, you know, several opposition candidates. There's Henri Falcón from the Progressive Advance Party. There's Javier Bertucci. But much of the opposition, maybe most of the opposition, including, you know, Leopoldo López, Enrique Capriles, Maria Corina Machado, they're calling for a boycott of the elections. They're saying that they won't be fair, they won't be free. Do you think that they're setting the stage for another round of violent protests in the near future after the elections?
So it's exactly as you said. The ones calling for a boycott are the ones that have been insisting on violence for 20 years now. They're trying to overthrow the Venezuelan government through violence. And we don't want a repeat of the violence. We don't want a repeat of the situations we've already lived through. In fact, the people calling for this sort of violence really need to be punished so that we can prevent this sort of thing from happening again.
And I wanted to ask you, what are the stakes of this election? You know, when you were telling your story about how you got involved in the committees of victims of violent protests, you know, you mentioned that you worked at the housing ministry. I think one thing, well, one of the many things that people in the United States never hear about is the grand housing mission Venezuela, where, you know, millions of homes are being built for families given away for essentially free. You know, also, by the way, the fact that there is a nursery in your workplace is something that would be, you know, completely life changing for so many working class mothers in the United States who have to spend huge amounts of money on, you know, childcare. Are these social programs, would they be eliminated if Nicolas Maduro does not win the election?
So I think if President Maduro were to lose, the first thing that would be eliminated would be the social missions. Because what capitalism does is it displaces all the programs that result in social progress and advances. Venezuela has made a lot of progress in terms of human rights and through its social missions. And as a human rights organization, we really have to advocate for these policies to continue and to not be canceled. And so one of the things we're seeing is that U.S. sanctions are harming human rights in Venezuela. It impedes the importation of food and of medicine, which directly affects the human right to having food and health. So I'll give you an example. Citibank canceled the accounts of the Central Bank of Venezuela, and the Central Bank is who's in charge of paying suppliers for food and medicine. Euroclear has retained $1.65 billion that belong to Venezuela, which is what the government has been using to import food and medicine. And another example of the harm caused by capitalism and the sanctions comes through BCN Laboratories in Colombia. It's a pharmaceutical company that Venezuela had purchased malaria medicine. But this bank, or this pharmaceutical, since it does banking with U.S. firms, on realizing that the malaria medicine was headed towards Venezuela, they canceled the sale. So these sanctions really affect the most vulnerable people in our country, and that's why we condemn them.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely crucial piece of information because, you know, in the U.S., it's presented like, okay, well, the Venezuelan economy is dependent on oil, the price of oil collapsed, and as a consequence, the economy collapsed, that there are no consumer goods available. And of course, you know, the price of oil does have a huge impact on the economy, but there's this whole other side that we never hear about, the side of the economic war, both the sanctions that are imposed by the United States, also the sabotage that's conducted by corporations on their own initiative. Eugenia, you know, in addition to these financial measures, the rhetoric that's been coming from the Trump administration is extremely hostile. I mean, Trump administration officials have said, you know, all options are on the table, which is a code word for an invasion, right? Code word for a military action. When the United States, you know, this historically dominant player in Latin America, when their government, this government, you know, makes those types of declarations, what does that do to political tensions in the country?
So, absolutely. So if the Trump administration's rhetoric is, I mean, we've seen it before, when the U.S. makes a threat, it carries out this threat. And if the Trump administration does not like our public policies, then there should be a different way of settling these differences rather than sanctions and threats. There should be, we should talk and we should engage in dialogue. Anything that leads to war has to be rejected by a human rights organization and is rejected by us, the activists and members of Funda Latin. Or you were speaking earlier of the elections, and we as a human rights organization, we have to recognize that there are over 60 political parties that are taking place in these, they're taking part in these elections. Part of the Venezuelan opposition registered to take to run in these elections, which we in Venezuela call a democratic party, a democratic fest. Over the last 20 years in Venezuela, we've held over 23 elections where the Venezuelan people participates democratically. And we have this media issue where you have these tiny minority parties who have gone across the world asking for the elections to not be recognized. But it's these same parties who have always been in favor of not taking the electoral route. And we appreciate that, you know, people like us, like Desiree and I, who are part of the Venezuelan people, can be interviewed here in this space since generally our voices aren't heard. We don't defend political parties. We defend the public policies that are related to human rights and the human rights progress we've made in our country. So they speak of a humanitarian crisis, but there is no humanitarian crisis in Venezuela. We are a people that has decided to live in sovereignty and freedom with the respect of human rights. But sadly, in the United States and Europe, only one side of the coin is seen. We as Venezuelans, we say no to intervention and yes to human rights and sovereignty. But unfortunately, we have leaders from the opposition who go around the world asking for more sanctions, for an economic blockade, for an oil embargo, and possibly for military action. I'm talking about men like Julio Borges and Antonio Ledesma.
Tell us how the Venezuelan election process works. What are the guarantees that there aren't, fraud, that fraud doesn't take place, that the votes are counted and reported accurately?
So as a human rights organization, we've participated as observers in two elections. And the world has been witness to how credible the electoral system is. We have voting machines, we have audits, we have all sorts of safeguards in place. The people who claim that there is fraud are the ones who have always opted for violence. The opposition, when they won the congressional elections in 2015, it was with the same National Electoral Council and the same system. And that was the one occasion they said that there was no fraud. And so that raises the question, why do they say there's fraud sometimes and not the other times?
What about the Constituent Assembly election? That's been, a political development that's been especially pointed to by those who want to say that Venezuela is a dictatorship. The elections that's coming up on May 20th are going to be for the presidency. But then there's also the Constituent Assembly that's, tasked with writing a new constitution and assumed many of the legislative functions of the government. Is that consistent with Venezuela's model of democracy?
It's absolutely legitimate. 8 million people came out to vote. Before this vote, we were living through times of political violence in 2017 when 121 people died. But then the people came out to vote, and democratically, this violence stopped. The National Constituent Assembly is completely legal, and they're consulting the people on all these decisions that they're making. As soon as the people came out to vote for this National Constituent Assembly, the violence stopped. This violence, it has to be noted, was generally localized in municipalities controlled by opposition mayors. I'll give you an example. Our headquarters, Funda Latin's headquarters, is located in a municipality where we have an opposition mayor. Our headquarters was burned. They broke our windows. They attacked our building because they considered us to be a Chavista collective, and therefore we had to be burned. And they were accompanied by the municipal government with masked protesters. And we denounced this in front of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. To date, the commission has yet to respond. We made this denouncement to the Special Rapporteur of the UN on Human Rights, and to yet they have not responded.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. We're joined in studio by two Venezuelan activists, Eugenia Rusian. She is the president of the Latin American Foundation for Human Rights and Social Development, the oldest human rights organization in Venezuela. She's been a nun with the Missionaries of Christ for over 20 years. We're also joined in studio by Desiree Cabrera. She's a member of the Committee of Victims of Violent Protests. Desiree, we were talking a little bit earlier about, the 43 people who were killed in the wave of opposition violence. And you mentioned that several of them, I believe you said eight of them were police officers. Several of the people who were held accountable for acts of violence were police officers. That's something that people in the United States would find very shocking, honestly, because, you know, time after time after time, police officers commit, you know, acts of violence, they kill people, they brutalize people, but there's almost never any accountability in the United States. But that's not really the case in Venezuela, right?
So as Sister Eugenia was saying, our constitution deals with human rights in kind of an intersectional way, and the state guarantees the human rights of the Venezuelan people. And so when we had victims who were subject to excessive force by security agents, the state had to come in and condemn and prison the ones who were responsible. And the majority of the people, of those who carried out this violence, the officers have already received their sentences and are already serving their sentences. So that's why we have to bring the truth about these events of 2014, because the narrative is that you have a government that violated the human rights of all these protesters, these supposedly peaceful protesters. When the truth was that you had actually very violent protesters who attacked the Venezuelan people in the name of liberty and democracy. And it's very contradictory for the United States to denounce human rights violations, alleged human rights violations in Venezuela, when here it's the systematic human rights violations against the American people.
Eugenia, you do workshops for members of the Caracas police about human rights, social rights, sensitivity to the communities that they police. Talk about the changes in policing that you've noted over the past decade or so.
Yes. In fact, at the University of the Security Forces, two of the primary topics they address are human rights and ethics. And we have other organizations that we've worked very closely with, other human rights organizations. They too work directly with this university. They do research there and they help train the officers. And our constitution clearly establishes a sense of co-responsibility between the state and society. And so it's very important for us to continue strengthening our public policies in terms of training and educating our public servants or public officers.
Yes, sorry. Let's turn back to 2014. So in 2014, there was this call to take part in these demonstrations. It followed the rejection of the election results that took place in 2013 when Nicolas Maduro was first elected. And the opposition was joined in rejecting the results by the United States government, by the State Department, then the Obama administration. And they were also joined by other governments around the world that are allied to the United States or, you know, within the Western orbit, right? So the European Union. Will there be observers in this election? Do you think that the international community will recognize the legitimacy of these elections?
En el 2014 se puede decir que la violencia ocurrió en parte por un rechazo a las elecciones del 2013. Y en ese entonces la oposición a ellos se les unió Estados Unidos, el Departamento de Estado, el presidente Obama, otros países aliados a Estados Unidos, como la Unión Europea, en rechazar esas sanciones y en apoyar a la oposición. Ahorita que vamos a tener elecciones otra vez, van a haber observaciones internacionales, ¿cuál va a ser el papel de la comunidad internacional en esto?
Over the 23 elections we've had in the last 20 years, they've all been accompanied by international and national observers. I don't believe it won't be different at all on May 20th. There will be observers, and it's very important to have this because it gives the process legitimacy. It's really important for these international observers to be on the ground so that they can see the protagonical role being played by the Venezuelan people in the elections, especially when you have a presidential election.
Eugenia, you know, the traditional demand of the opposition is to allow international observers to come in, allow international observers from organizations that are, you know, traditionally hostile to the government. But this time, there are actually protests organized by the opposition against, I believe it was the United Nations, demanding that they do not send observers to this election. Talk about that.
Well, as you mentioned this, we have to make it clear that it's not the entire opposition. It's a small part of the opposition that is calling for this boycott, and it's this small part that has always relied on violence. And they have the support of the corporate media. And yet, a huge part of the opposition is calling for people to vote. And they're calling this other opposition sector is calling for people to vote, and they're calling for international observers to come see the people celebrate their elections.
Let's talk about the regional context in Latin America. When you look at the human rights situation in Venezuela and compare it to other countries in the region, Well, how does it compare? And talk a little bit about the historical importance of human rights to activists, to progressive people in Latin America, in terms of, you know, the dictatorships that have traditionally ruled many countries in the region, many of which were installed or at least supported by the United States. How does it stack up in terms of other countries in Latin America compared with Venezuela?
Well, let's look at Brazil with Lula, who was recently forbidden from running in the elections, despite the fact that polls show him having support of over 57% of the people. In Argentina, we see Macri cutting pensions, cutting salaries, and hurting teachers by rolling back the gains they had made in human rights. In Colombia, we already have more than 100 journalists, human rights activists, and indigenous people murdered. But the eyes of the OAS Secretary General Luis Almagro are only on Venezuela. So I think it's up to us, the social movements, the human rights organizations, and activists, to recover this integration of peoples and to make sure that we can live in sovereignty and in freedom with human rights.
Desiree, we have just a little bit under a minute left. You get the last word. What's your message to the people of the United States? How can people here support the independence, the sovereignty, the people in Venezuela?
By rejecting the coercive measures against the people of Venezuela, which is causing an economic blockade that prevents the importation of food and medicine. So the way to support us is to join us in rejecting and condemning these measures, because the United States cannot intervene in Venezuela. It should not intervene. They're attempting to create a humanitarian crisis.
That's all the time we have left. We've been joined in the studio by Eugenia Rusian. She is the president of the Latin American Foundation for Human Rights and Social Development, the oldest human rights organization in Venezuela. She's been a nun with the Missionaries of Christ for over 20 years. We've been joined also in studio by Desiree Cabrera. She is a member of the Committee of Victims of Violent Protests. In 2014, the nursery where her 19-month-old baby was being cared for was attacked by right-wing protesters. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We will be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.